There's a lot to chew through there, and we're going to have a bit of a Q&A now. The number you can text through to, I think it is it on the screen now? Please do send your questions through. We'll get through as many as we can. I apologize in advance for the ones we don't get to. I've got a, I can sort of steal it a bit and ask you a couple to get us started, Tim. I love the fact that you seem sort of optimistic about this. Like, a lot of people are good at discerning the problem, and there are obvious problems in this area, but you actually seem to believe we can do something about it. So I love that about you. But what makes you so sure?
Well, we have one society that we live in, so we got to work to the best we can, I think. But if you think in past history, there have also been times of great transition that have been difficult to navigate. If you think of the why did this colony start, late 1700s, because industrialization was breaking down social order in Britain. And there was a problem of kind of out of control law and order and agricultural society. It was not. It was, life was pretty miserable. London was an awful city to live in, for example. A variety of things took place in the subsequent years through the early 1800s, a lot of social reforms in the first half of that century, a lot of community-based activism that changed things. I think that, this is the stuff of history. Each of us in each generation, we inherit a set of challenges. This is ours. They're significant. But there's very practical things that you can do at a very small level, as well as some of the kind of the grander things that I've spoken of.
Yes, I think it was PJ O'Rourke who said, anyone who thinks life was better in the 19th century, just think of one thing, dentistry, which seems to make sense. You had both a sort of professional reason to jump in on this, but also a very personal reason. You alluded to it earlier. I wondered if you could just briefly mention what was a very tragic moment in your life that kind of spurred you into some of this work.
Yeah, well, I was working on particularly the refugee crisis in 2015, going into 2016, and trying to, with the history of having watched the way that the refugee debate had gone in Australia over the last two decades, and seeing the same thing happening in Europe, I was working on that in 2016, and thinking a lot about these issues of what drives division and what's driving those narratives. And I was working with Brennan Cox, the husband of Jo Cox, the British Labour MP. Jo was also a friend. Jo had actually been a fantastic champion of the work that I'd done on Syria. She was a great, outstanding advocate for refugees, had only been in Parliament for 12 months at that time, but had made a real impact, had built a lot of relationships with people across the political divides. And I was with Brendan when he got notified that she'd been attacked, and as it turned out, that she'd been murdered by one of her own constituents, which has actually never happened before in British history. Obviously, for me personally, being thrown into that was, indescribably strange and horrific. But at the same time, Joe was the kind of person who was, literally the following day, was sitting around with five people who were close friends of hers, and there was this sort of moment when we were obviously in deep grief and shock and everything like that, but there was this moment where we just said, well, what would Joe want us to do? And we all kind of laughed and realised, well, of course she'd get us off our butts to do something good in this time of despair and tragedy. So we did. We started a crowdfunder for some of her causes. We asked the family what mattered to them. We raised £2 million, in the space of a few weeks. We saw a whole. I think it was a moment where we were able to change a narrative from, a profoundly tragic event to people coming together in response to that in a more positive way. And the words "more in common" actually come from her first speech in Parliament, where she said, in the very diverse community she represented in West Yorkshire, essentially half Muslim and half white British population, we have more in common than what divides us. So that moment of realizing that we're not in the same game that we've been in before, that a woman who goes into politics with a relatively low profile, stands up for important causes, can be killed on the streets of her own constituency, a quiet constituency. I think it points to, I don't think it's a one-off event, tragically. I mean, I think that's all of the drivers of that are there around us. We're going to see more of these sorts of incidents. And for me, it was, you know, it was a point of, well, you know, what do you do in those moments? You try to turn those things around. And after that event, I guess I had a different realization of what's happening around us and what it means.
Mm. Thank you. Questions are rolling in, so let's get to some of these. Do you think there's any viable alternative to liberal democracy?
some Singaporean model advocates amongst us, those are benevolent illiberal democracies. But I'm not sure what's being proposed. I'm sure that there are moments when we do feel the exhaustion of democratic process and think there might be easier ways. But look, liberal democracy is what has made possible so much human progress, has its flaws, but it gives the opportunity to give everybody a voice, to respect and the freedoms and rights of everyone, to build more inclusive societies. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a... We, for all the flaws, it's the best system that has given us the most progress, and I do think it's in troubled times.
Hmm. Okay, here's one from our audience. What simple narrative do you suggest the cosmopolitans should offer to counter the effective storytelling of, they say, the Nationals, but it could be others.
I think this. There's a conscious story of trying to talk about us in a very inclusive way. The trick is that what you tend to do, coming from a cosmopolitan bias, and that's me, you know, my background is kind of, you know, Labour Party politics. The natural thing that you do is you elevate difference and you celebrate difference, and it's great virtue signalling to your own tribe to show that you're all for diversity. But what we know from our research is that the most people in the population are terrified by that message because they see diversity and change all around them and they perceive that as being quite threatening. They're actually like okay with it, but what they need at the moment is a message that reminds them of actual commonality, because what they're seeing is fracturing. And many people in those middle groups, I don't think this is racism. I don't think it's sort of profound prejudice. I think it's totally understandable if you think of their context. They hear us talking about difference and think that that means somebody else is being preferred over them. They worry about that. What, on the other hand, if you frame a lot of this story of us through the lens of all of us together benefiting, not one group benefiting at the expense of the other, there's overwhelming support for that. So that's I think that's the key. It's to think constantly of the message of all of us. It's not extinguishing at all the voices of minorities. It's elevating everybody together, not allowing that to become a sort of fight between, like a rivalry between groups.
Mm. Now, one of the big challenges in this is, seems to me, that it always sounds good in theory, but when there's some difference that you and I have that's deeply personal to me, It's a much harder ask, isn't it? And these are the things that people talk about and typically dividing each other these days often are very, there's a personal element to it. So do you have any suggestions for that?
Well, that's something that we've tried to do in our work is to understand these deeper moral values. So we've used Jonathan Haidt's work on moral foundations, which we find is really powerfully predictive, actually. So a really practical example, we're about to bring a paper out on immigration attitudes in the United States. We have found, we looked at the correlation between a ton of different things about how people think and their stance on immigration. We found that there is one thing that is really consistent among people who are more opposed on immigration issues, on all the controversial issues in the US, and that is that they're people who prioritise authority, that is kind of order, rules, everybody should follow the same rules. Now, That's not the wrong value. Actually, if you look, majority of the people we find who are concerned about those issues, about you know, the sort of the system and the rules and deferring to authorities, etc. The majority of those people are actually like quite strong in compassion as well. That is to say that they're not cruel people, but they prefer a different moral value. Now, once you know that, actually, you can have a conversation about that. And I think that that's the thing. It's like, it's not assuming the worst. It's starting from a position of respect. And we have a lot to learn. We have a lot to learn when we do that. I mean, I feel that in the work that I've done. I feel, you know, that my experiences are limited in many ways compared to other people. And so going into the conversation and the engagement with an expectation that people might have a legitimate view that's different from yours, it's different. I mean, that's not the way that we're behaving now politically. It's not the way that social media is shaping us.
Hmm. Robert Putnam's book, American Grace, which tracks and it largely tells the story of why it is that despite such enormous religious diversity in America, it doesn't all end up in a bloodbath. And he puts it down to what he calls the Aunt Susan effect. Everybody knows someone who sort of defies the stereotype. Oh, you know, I hate all those people, but Aunt Susan's one of them and she's okay. Now, in Australia, they say that 2/3 of people don't know a person who's Christian, like not in any sort of meaningful way. I wonder if you could comment on how serious that problem might be for the Christians, at least.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're all responsible when we're in bubbles, right? So I think that is, an absolutely religious communities can be, you know, as bubbly as the rest, maybe sometimes more so. That doesn't surprise me. I'd not heard of that statistic before. But I think this challenge of trying to more actively think about the way that we connect with people who are different from us is really important, because it kind of just used to happen when we had a lot more, life on our street, in our neighbourhood, when our neighbourhoods weren't so split as well by the price of housing, you know, which is, we're much more stratified that way as well. The PNC at school, all those sorts of things. I mean, people had more time. So I think that we have to consciously rebuild social institutions for the 21st century that do that. Not all of them are going to look the same as they might have done in previous generations. But, you know, we've got to really consciously work against the grain, because the sort of echo chamber, filter bubble, sort of isolation that's happening is really to the detriment of all of us.
Yeah. Okay, someone's asked, could you please speak more about the constructive role of journalism and the media in addressing these issues?
Yeah. It's another point, actually, on the, those sort of 7 points I mentioned. That was one thing that I kind of knocked out of that list, but I think it's a very important one. At a few different levels. So one level is that I think that journalists are drawn from... It's one of the things helpful about this analysis of the characteristics of cosmopolitans versus the rest is mostly journalists tend to be drawn from that cosmopolitan group. So when you get somebody like Gabriel Chan, for example, who's sort of breaking out of that, you know, city-centred thing and writing about life in rural Australia, doing fantastic work, you know, it's really refreshing, but also quite rare, which is kind of subverting the norm. So one aspect is journalists, reporters, culture makers in general tend to come from one tribe and therefore be, and you know, a lot of the things that they prioritise in terms of the stories that they cover, the issues they cover, just tend to be a reflection of personal judgments. So being aware of those differences is one thing that's helpful. I mean, more generally, how you get out of playing out all of our issues in this silly, immature, polarised, you know, he said, she said style of politics, which people hate. I don't know, you know, I think that the financial constraints on media are a big thing that's driving that. We need to find business models that support reporting and media, because the business models we've got at the moment are not working to give us the kind of quality in an environment where a lot of money is going into disinformation. So I think it's a really important area. I think it's something that philanthropy and new models of financing are going to be important for.
We've got a text that's come through clearly from the wrong number. It says, "Hey man, can you help Vince with the chicken wings when you're here?"
I'll be right on it.
So Poor Vince is going to be left to his own devices, I think. People are interested in your personal story to some degree, and this touches on it, but it says, if you were around for the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd thing, what are your thoughts on the Turnbull-Abbott-Turnbull-Morrison thing? Why can't we keep a prime minister?
Yeah, well, I think that's it is strange. I mean, it's hard to explain, isn't it? The sort of behaviour replicating and sort of taking even further the dysfunction. You know, look, there's better people than me have sought to explain that. The thing that I feel about the dynamics of how it's affecting the country is this. I do think it's undermining confidence in a democratic system. I think that in some countries, it's the shifts in the public that, in a sense, have changed the politics. I think that we're uniquely, in Australia, actually we've been uniquely let down by our political leadership. You know, for a bunch of reasons that just aren't that, you know, important or sensible. We actually are a much less fractured society than many of the countries that I'm particularly studying. There's a really good Ipsos study that came out last week that was looking at polarisation, tribalism in different ways. And it looked at Australians' perception of people who have different points of view than them. And Australia ranks among the kind of 27, 28 countries, I think, that they did. Australia was really at the bottom end of that, and that is much less polarised, less fractured. Now, the forces are still here. You know, something terrible might happen in our country or our economy or a convulsion, and I think all of the dynamics that I'm describing elsewhere could quickly come into play. I mean, we know that they're already in play, right? But I think that actually, you know, many ways we're in a better place in our society compared to many others, but yeah, the politics wouldn't make you think that.
Someone said that you mentioned your faith shapes your approach to some of this. They asked, would you outline some of the ways that happens, and should people who are not of faith be worried about that?
Well, I think that there's a long history of people in politics coming from faith backgrounds, or in the case of particularly the Labor Party, people who are the children of ministers. Sometimes they actually have to say better embody the values of Christian faith than the more overtly religious ones. I think that people should be totally upfront in the values that shape them. None of that should be hidden. But I think that for me, there's particular reasons why, you know, I chose Labor Party politics. It was around kind of values. I equally have very good friends who are in conservative parties or in Greens. And I think all political parties, all of our mainstream parties, have, traditions, great traditions, like strong values that people can elevate and work now, you know. I'm also not completely a relativist. Like, there are particular reasons that take me into the Labor Party world. But I think that people of faith are a good contribution. I'm not a fan of political parties that are entirely derived from religious identity. I think that can be tribal and divisive. But I think that, you know, it's by and large a positive thing that you get people who are inspired by faith and a set of values who go into public life.
Now, Jesus didn't seem to be into social cohesion to me. He was a very divisive figure, wasn't he? But does he have something to say about this topic?
Well, I think that he was in a highly polarised environment, but what's the wonderful story? There's just a line in the scripture at the time when I think it's the time of Jesus being sent off to crucifixion. And is it Pilate talking to Herod? And it's saying that they kind of became friends after that, that there was sort of a connection, I mean, even in the most tragic kind of moment. I think that, you know, the whole story of preferring the least, in so many of the parables, of not claiming the top spot, is the stuff that makes social glue. And the story of, you know, as I said, the ministry of reconciliation doesn't mean that there aren't moments of polarization or that there isn't scope for righteous anger or any of those things. I think that those, but, you know, Jesus never showed contempt to people. And that's profoundly different.
Perhaps two more. Do you see the possibility for a new major political party in Australia, or do the current major parties need to regenerate themselves? Sorry, being asked these expert. You've come from this area.
Totally. Well, so I am. Let me jump to the UK for a minute. I am profoundly worried in the United Kingdom that so there's incredible dissatisfaction of conservatives with the Conservative Party, of Labour people with the Labour Party, and the Lib Dems, you know, really don't figure in all of this either. I'm really worried that the space is wide open for a new party to jump in there that's kind of us versus them, nasty, divisive, and it's 30% in 6 months' time. In fact, I would almost be surprised if that doesn't happen, the level of, you know, 80% dissatisfaction with the whole system. Are new parties good? Well, I mean, you know, politics takes its own course. But the institutions that are there, to the extent it's possible to renovate them, we totally should. So in Australia, I don't think there's the same level of dissatisfaction. I don't think, when I talk about this middle, I think the issue to me is actually more about how the institutions that are there, I mean, I don't think they're at a state of advanced collapse, but I think that they're demonstrating all of these dynamics of tribalism, and I think it's genuinely difficult because it's actually the people who are in the room. You know, it's the dynamics, it's the social media dynamics that are driving politics. So, you know, you start a new party, the same thing is going to happen. And I don't think that you mobilise people around an identity that's a sort of centrist identity either, because as I was saying before, it's like the centre, the middle is kind of very angry as well. So, I don't think the answer is necessarily a new party. You know, those things might happen. But I think it's much more about how do we think about what are the incentives that drive the behaviour of people in politics? How can we change those incentives so that they're healthier? Because, you know, I've got many friends in political life on, you know, both sides of politics. I get it that it is hard to do politics in a respectful way in an age of contempt. You know, all of us have to take responsibility. The media is a really important part of that, but all of us have to. How do we change those dynamics on social media? It's not easy. But when we see it and when people in politics demonstrate that, we should really actively reward it.
Well, one more. As we all leave here and head out into our lives in various places, bottom line, what's our role in being part of the glue rather than the thing that fractures?
Well, I think consciously trying to, you know, get outside your bubble is obviously one part of this. And thinking about the way in which, you know, thinking about discourse, the way in which we engage difference. So pushing ourselves and acting with respect, I think that's the starting point because, you know, it is just as contempt can be contagious, I think also a different culture, a culture of respect and connection can also be contagious. And some of the most interesting initiatives around the world to counter fracturing and polarisation have actually literally started in people's kitchens. Like, they've started in very, very small ways. So, you know, one of the challenges when you present the kind of palette of issues that I have is that it's, you know, it's a bit overwhelming and disempowering. But I do think that this is as simple as, you know, starting with the relationships of people around you, the community that you're in, you know, your church, your political party, whatever it is, and trying to consciously build connection, particularly to people who are outside your bubble, and all of us can do that.
Will you thank Tim Dixon for me? Thank you.